Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Andrew Oldham. I'm from the Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. My chambers are here in Austin. It is wonderful to be here and to be able to moderate this panel this afternoon with three of my dear friends. We're going to do it in traditional Federalist Society format. Each person will have a few minutes to give some opening remarks. I'll ask a couple of questions just to get us get the ball rolling, but we want to leave plenty of time for the audience. So as we have the previous panels, please just cue on either side of the room, and I'll try to go back and forth between the two microphones. Obviously, you can read much more about the distinguished bios of our distinguished panelists, but I will just briefly introduce my three friends. First, today, we're going to hear from Professor Judd Campbell from the University of Richmond School of Law, and then two colleagues from the George Mason Antonin Scalia School of Law, Ilya Soman, and then last but certainly not least, Michael Grieva. So please join me in welcoming our distinguished panelists.
All right, thanks so much. I'm a constitutional historian, so I'm gonna get us started by focusing on different views of how the nature of the union used to animate and frame constitutional debates about federalism. One of the things that I find so fun and also challenging about studying constitutional history is that earlier generations often didn't share our perspective about the nature of constitutional law. So for us, the thing that grounds constitutional argument is the written constitution. We treat the text as a source of fundamental law, and then, as Justice Scalia would say, the rest is a matter of interpretation. In taking this approach, we've mostly rejected other ways of grounding constitutional law, including concepts like social contract theory, natural rights, and natural law. These are things that might come up in a philosophy class, but they're very unlikely to have any relevance to modern constitutional debate. But Americans from the founding throughout the 19th century simply did not share this perspective. So for them, the text mattered a great deal, but there was a deeper foundation, a more fundamental source of authority. So to think historically about problems like federalism, we need to be open to imagining the nature of constitutional law and the grounding of constitutional law in a different way. So I'm gonna start by sketching out older ways of thinking about this and then turn to why things get so messy in particular in the context of federalism debates. So let's just start with social contract theory, which framed how the founders thought about the purposes and limitations of governmental authority. The basic gist was that God created humans as political equals, endowed those humans with natural rights, which are basically capacities that they could enjoy in a proverbial state of a nature, subject only to the limits of natural law. And among other things, the basic point of this was to demonstrate that governmental authority had to be rooted in consent, not divine right. And in particular, the notion of consent is that there's an imagined social contract through which the people unanimously agree to form a self-governing polity. And then it's only after the creation of that foundational agreement, after political authority is vested in a polity, that the people would then create a system of government through a second agreement called a constitution. So in other words, the Constitution is subsequent. It's predicated on an earlier and more fundamental compact, the social contract. Now, everything I've just said is widely accepted at the founding. It's foundational in social contractarian writings like those of Locke, Hobbes, Blackstone, and so on. But those sources all are presupposing a single polity. So what makes debates about federalism so dynamic and unstable is that Americans are confronting how these ways of thinking about constitutionalism map onto a federal system. So for the remainder of my remarks, I'm going to briefly summarize four main responses to this problem, which we can associate with the thinking of James Wilson, John Marshall, James Madison, and then finally Thomas Jefferson. And then I want to end by highlighting a few implications of each of those views. So let's start off with Wilson. He's the most nationalistic of those thinkers. He thinks that there's federal sovereignty that's created at the time of independence in 1776, vesting the United States and its people with certain national rights and national powers. And really interestingly, later Reconstruction Republicans pick up on this idea and advocate a sort of conception of paramount national citizenship, inherent power, and so on. A second view, this is the view advocated by people including John Marshall, is that federal sovereignty is actually created through the adoption of a constitution, whereby the people of several states transfer aspects of their sovereignty to a unitary people of the United States. So from a genealogical standpoint, the United States is born of the states, but after ratification of the Constitution, the United States' status as a sovereign entity is basically treated as if it had been born of its own accord, not genealogically traced back to the ratification. So we can call this 1787 nationalism. The third view is Madison's. He agrees with Marshall's genealogical account of where we get federal sovereignty, but for Madison, he thought the unique status of the United States having been created through the states, through this delegation of sovereignty, makes the United States a sort of hybrid entity. So it's nationally sovereign in some sense, but with national sovereignty still grounded on this account of the transfer from states. And so we can think of this as a kind of quasi-nationalism. And then finally, we've got Jefferson, who thought that although the Constitution did delegate certain powers to a national government, it did not create a national body politic. And of course, this is the position that, among others, John C. Calhoun and Jefferson Davis later embraced. So all of these four positions are historically available. Wilson's 1776 nationalism, Marshall's 1787 nationalism, Madison's quasi-nationalism, and then Jefferson's denial of national sovereignty. Importantly, this is not a philosophical debate. It is a debate that deeply animates thinking about actual constitutional questions. Everybody agrees that the way in which you think about the allocation of sovereignty profoundly affects how to read the Constitution. So this is why virtually all of the 19th century treatise writers start with accounts of the nature of the Union. John Pomeroy, for instance, notes that, quote, all the relations of the United States and the several commonwealths to each other and of all the functions of the general and local governments must depend on our notions of the essential character of this organic law and of the body politic which lies behind it. So everybody's taking text seriously. But as Pomeroy is pointing out, these underlying debates about the nature of the Union are enabling people to see the text in very different ways. So how does this actually cash out? Well, for people like Jefferson, the text is basically like a treaty among sovereign states, and therefore it had to be interpreted through principles of strict construction. And on this view, it made no sense to have non-textual federal powers or non-textual limits on state power like the Dormant Commerce Clause. And this way of thinking also animates the view that states ultimately have the authority to decide on questions of constitutional meaning. For Madison, the Constitution was a textual marker of an agreement, a historical agreement at a particular moment of time, whereby the peoples of the several states created this national entity, and therefore we should interpret the Constitution in light of what their agreement was, thinking specifically about the ratifier's intent. So you could imagine then there being some implied powers or some implied limits on state power, but it has to be tied back to some notion of an actual intent by the ratifiers of the Constitution. And this way of thinking also led Madison to the view that although individual states could not ultimately determine constitutional meaning, collectively the states were the most responsible for ascertaining the meaning of the Constitution. And then finally, we've got the nationalist view, and here I'll focus on Marshall. For him, the Constitution has this unique genealogy But it needed to be interpreted in the same way as state constitutions. So this meant, for instance, that you could settle ambiguities in the Constitution by looking to the preamble. It also meant that there was space for argument about inherent power or space for argument about implied limits on state power. Things like the Dormant Commerce Clause at least might make sense on this view. And it also meant that national institutions were the supreme expositors of constitutional meaning. And this is the key upshot of the Marshall Court's most famous decisions, things like Martin versus Hunter's lessee, McCulloch versus Maryland, and so on. So if you're getting the sense that American constitutional law is deeply unstable at this point, you're on the right track. And I want to tie this back then to the topic of the panel. My point here is not simply that different forms of federalism, different answers to this question about the native nature of the union might have different implications for the way that we think about American unity or disunity. That's certainly true, but rather I think the more profound point here is that the views of American unity or disunity actually came logically prior to how you thought about questions of federalism. So you can't know how to approach constitutional law without first thinking through problems about the locus of sovereignty in the federal system. So in other words, understanding the nature of the union is a predicate of and not merely a product of constitutional interpretation. Thanks.
Thank you. Professor Summitt.
Thank you to the Federalist Society for organizing this event. Is the mic working now? Maybe not.
Okay, now it's working. All right, so now that we've straightened out our technical difficulties, the show will go on and must go on. So I'd like to thank the Federalist Society for organizing this event and all of you for coming. Our topic in this panel is the extent to which federalism contributes to or possibly undermines unity. And in one sense, federalism necessarily undermines unity because it means there will be divergence and diversity on at least some policy areas. If there's no policy differences between the states, then there's little point in having federalism. But in my talk, I will suggest that even though federalism has this obvious and intended consequence of promoting a degree of disunity, it can also promote unity in a different sense and empower people as well to make better choices. I'll start off by talking about how federalism actually promotes unity through diversity. Then I'll talk about how it further promotes diversity and also better empowerment and choice by empowering people to vote with their feet. And then finally, I'll talk a little about some limitations of the vision that I'm going to sketch out. So first things first, while federalism does have this necessarily disunifying element where different states and often different localities as well have divergent policies and disagreements, that very diversity can help promote unity because unity is harder to achieve if you have to agree on a wide range of different things. Obviously, in this current era of American politics, we have severe polarization between left and right, Democrats and Republicans and so forth. But one reason why the polarization is as bad as it is because the federal government in general and the presidency in particular are so powerful that there's a fear that, you know, if the other side gets in control of those institutions, they can control vast areas of our lives and vast aspects of society. If they controlled somewhat less, the danger would be less, and it would be easier to reconcile ourselves to having what we might regard as the wrong party in charge of the White House or in control of Congress. And leaving more issues to the state or local level can accomplish this. It reduces the need for nationwide agreement or consensus on issues, and also it reduces the opportunities for 51% to impose on 49%. Or vice versa, by using the powers of the federal government. The common analogy that's often given for the relationship between the red and the blue states is that it's a failing marriage. You know, they're fighting all the time. there's even thinking maybe they should divorce or whatnot, but in any event, they certainly don't like each other and they've fallen out of love. I think divorce, as some have called for, is unrealistic and undesirable for various reasons we can talk about in questions if people are interested, but I do think it's more realistic to say that these states and these groups can spend more time apart and do fewer things together, and having to do fewer things together can enable them to get along better and also enable them to be happier in general because more people could live under policies they like. And while just simply having static, immobile federalism, that can achieve this to some extent because at least there's variation based on what the local majority is, empowering people to vote with their feet by moving around to different states and localities so that they can choose the package of government policies that best suits them, that can empower them even more. Now, even if you're in the minority in your particular state, if foot voting is relatively easy, you have the option of choosing from 49 others, some of which might be more congenial. And also, foot voting has two other important advantages over just voting at the ballot box. One is that when you vote at the ballot box, as was pointed out in the last panel, the chance that your vote will make a difference, the outcome, is infinitesimally small. In a presidential election, it's about 1 in 60 million. Even in a state or local election, it's pretty low. But if you can vote with your feet, that's a choice that really will make a big difference. You have a high chance of making a difference if you're allowed to move from one state to another or one locality to another. And for that very reason, you have a better incentive to make an informed choice. That most voters, when they vote at the ballot box, they're what economists call rationally ignorant. They have very little incentive to learn about the issues at stake because there's so little chance it'll make a difference. As a result, extensive evidence, including some that I've gathered in my own work, shows that most voters know very little about what they're voting on. Only about a third of Americans can even name the three branches of the federal government, the executive, the legislative, and the judicial, and they know even less about the details of policy. When people vote with their feet, they get better information, they seek out more of it, they also do a better job of evaluating it. If you're like most people, you probably spent more time and effort seeking out information the last time you decided what television set to buy than the last time you decided who to vote for president or governor or any other political office. It's not because the TV is more important or deals with more important issues than the president does. It's that you know that the TV you pick is probably the one that will actually end up in your living room, but when you turn it on and you have the misfortune of seeing the president or some other powerful government official, your chance of affecting who that is or what policies they will pursue is infinitesimally small, and therefore you generally most likely don't spend more than minimal time on that. And I would add that empowering people to vote with their feet can reduce conflict as well, in that it enables still more people to be in a situation where they at least generally like the policies that they're living under, and therefore they have less need to fear their fellow citizens, including even those citizens who are on the other side politically. There are some people who worry if we let people vote with their feet too much, it's going to be a big sort. All the conservatives live in one place or in a few places, all the liberals in another, and we'll be even more polarized and even more divided. I think this is largely not true because people's foot voting choices often don't track crude left-right differences. It turns out, for instance, people like to foot vote for places with relatively more job opportunities and lower taxes. So you can say those are red areas, but they also like places that are more diverse and more tolerant, which are more blue in nature. And if you look at something like Texas, which is one of the states that has gained the most in migration from other states in recent years, the people moving to Texas in recent years are about equally divided between Democrats and Republicans. So it's simply not true to say all the Republicans going to one place, all the Democrats to another. I admit, and the last part of my presentation is devoted to this, that this vision I've laid out does have some constraints and limitations. One is you do need to block states and localities from adopting policies that make it difficult or impossible for people to move, the biggest and most significant of which is exclusionary zoning, which makes it difficult in many places or even impossible to build new housing in response to demand. There is also the problem of immobile assets like property and land, so I think we need centralized constitutional protection for them precisely because they can't be moved out of jurisdictions that might oppress those kinds of interests. and also federal enforcement of certain kinds of individual rights can both facilitate foot voting between states, but also facilitate foot voting in the private sector between private institutions, which sometimes can be even more effective than foot voting between states, because often you don't even have to physically move. If, for instance, there is a private school choice program where you can send your kids to either public or private schools as you wish, then you have a much wider foot voting options without even having to buy a house or physically move to another jurisdiction. But centralized enforcement of these individual rights is valuable to facilitate that. And I also admit that foot voting is not the only consideration that should be factor when we decide how centralized our polity should be, which powers should be in the hands of the federal government versus the states or localities. There is going to be other considerations, like, for example, there may be some issues which are so large scale, they can only be dealt with by the federal government or even only by international agreement. Global warming, I think, is an example of this. However, the vast majority of political issues are likely not this way. If you believe that countries like Denmark or Switzerland or New Zealand can have their own healthcare policies, their own pension policies, their own education policies, and so forth, then the same is true of American states, and in some cases also American cities, which are roughly the same size or actually larger than some of these small countries. So most of what is on our political agenda does not have this aspect of being so large scale that only the federal government can effectively deal with it. It just isn't true for most issues. So we can decentralize a lot to the local or state level and therefore have unity through diversity and also empower people to vote with their feet. And in some cases, we can empower them even further by devolving all the way to the level of the private sector, where there's even more room for competition and choice. And speaking of competition, Michael Grieva, who I will turn over to floor to in a moment, has written a lot about how we can structure federal systems to stimulate competition between different states for people, for business and so forth, and that also can enhance foot voting even more, though I don't 100% endorse all of his ideas about how that should be done. So on that note, I conclude and I look forward to the rest of the presentation and the questions. Thank you.
You know, looking at all these bright young faces reminds me that I have known Gene Meyer for 37 years. More than once over those years, following sort of Federalist presentations, Gene has asked me, Mike, could you please just once, okay, say something uplifting? Something inspirational. Today, ladies and gentlemen, this bright and fun afternoon, the moment has come for me to disappoint Gene once again. I want to highlight some features of our federalism that are plainly calculated to make us less united in a very bad way. And unfortunately, I think these features are very prominent. To preface this, look, federalism is a they, not an it. So it comes in many forms. They have very different implications. I'll talk about the federalism that we now have. I will mostly talk about matters of political economy in Jim Buchanan's sense, but I want to start with the Constitution. And just to reassure my friend, Sandy Levinson, I am not going to over-venerate the Constitution. The Constitution isn't perfect, but it's a whole lot better than what we have now. So if you look at the Constitution, what does it tell you about states? States are equal, they are territorial, and they have a certain amount of political integrity. And they are supposed to operate on principles of non-aggression, non-discrimination, open borders, self-government. All of that is collected in Article 1, Section 10, and then in Article 4. The glitch with that elegant scheme is that under those principles, federalism operates the way Ilya likes it, the way I like it. People move, okay? It's competitive up to a point. The downside is both for citizens and especially for elected officials that federalism and that deployment has a very disciplining tendency. You can't just misgovern people because they're gonna run away and take their assets with them. So for state officials and state citizens, it's much more convenient to tax and regulate people in other states because they can't run away and they can't run vote you out of office. The Constitution is meant to block that maneuver, the courts, the federal courts, are supposed to be the first line of defense defending the constitutional lines. That's why there's diversity jurisdiction. That's why most of the provisions of Article 1, Section 10, and Article 4 are self-enforcing. The howler, of course, is that we haven't enforced any of these rules in 100 years, and we're not going to do so tomorrow. So over time, states have discovered institutional technologies to exploit one another, mostly with their local citizens' support, and I suppose you can call that democracy enhancing. I'll give you four examples. Two of them are examples of unilateral state action, and the other two are accomplished through Congress and administrative agencies. So here are the new unilateral ways of state exploitation of citizens in other states. I teach a course, among other courses, that's called Conflict of Laws, famously known as the insane asylum of the American legal profession. It has three parts. The first two parts are jurisdiction and choice of law. What's the governing principle of state jurisdiction? Answer, every state, every one of the 50 states has jurisdiction to the end of the planet, or at least to the ends of the country. There are a few wrinkles and exceptions, but that's the baseline. And the baseline of choice of law is something called interest analysis, which is the law of the forum, that is, of whatever, you know, state court the plaintiff's lawyers happen to sort themselves, governs the analysis. Is there a constitutional limit? Yes, the Supreme Court has said, but it's very, very weak. It operates at the absolute outer margins. And besides, we're not going to tell you what that is, that limit is. The second unilateral way of state exploitation is to export regulation, import goods, export regulation. So there's a case pending in the United States Supreme Court called National Pork Producers Council versus Ross. It concerns a California statute that prohibits the sale of pork and any product containing pork in the state of California unless the pig that from which the pork comes has a pen the size of my living room, a daily shower, a daily massage, and a gluten-free diet from spa to table, okay? Now, does California have pork producers? Yes, the California state legislature. Other than that, no. So California is entirely, you know, exporting the cost of this regulation to other states. This strategy is called, by antitrust lawyers, raising rivals costs. California has done this on many margins, including eggs, foie gras, and most important, energy. Here are the two ways in which states can achieve through Congress the imposition of costs on other states and mutual state exploitation. The first is conditional funding statutes, of which there are more than 1,200 by now. You know, I get nervous when conservatives cite Justice Brandeis, ooh, states as laboratories of democracy. He didn't have in mind some innocent little state experimenting on its own in its corner. His idea of federalism was island hopping, okay? So you establish a beachhead for some socialist program in Wisconsin. Then you find a few other states to go along with you, and then you lean on the Congress and say, please give us money so that we can govern ourselves, okay? And then you create and you structure the conditional funding program so that effectively a state that withdraws from that program leaves money on the table and none can realistically withdraw. These programs are frequently misunderstood as a form of nationalization or harmonization. They're mostly a demand, state demand-driven phenomenon. And the final form that I want to mention is, again, a form of raising rivals' costs. And the biggest example that comes to mind is the Clean Power Plan, right? So if New York and Massachusetts and California can persuade EPA to regulate greenhouse gases as a pollutant under the Clean Air Act, the in-state benefits in New York, in California, and in Massachusetts are zero, okay? And they will remain zero for the next 100 years at least, okay? There are no in-state benefits. What there is a gargantuan cost on Texas, Oklahoma, and other states, and we can predict who they are. And you look at the Clean Power Plan in its original Obama formulation, it's totally gerrymandered against energy producing and, as it happens, Republican states. How serious is this? I'd be happy to discuss that. I just want to conclude on three brief observations. The first thing is you don't want to think about this as the way sort of conventional economists think about this. Ooh, externalities, that's a federalism problem. Externalities are everywhere, okay? Externalities is what happens when you have federalism. Everything any state does affects states other states in some way or another. Some of these externalities you want to be concerned about, others you want to ignore. What this is about is, you know, concerted aggression, and that's a very different thing. And you want to worry about not so much the economic cost, but about the sort of institutional corruption. The second thing is, and this is sort of implied in my remarks, I think, this is obviously polarizing the country, right? Think of the Clean Air Act. Think of the Affordable Care Act. Think of the education debates that we're having. And the third and final remark is this is made much, much more dangerous by executive government, okay? Because the executive is in charge of an enormous regulatory apparatus, an enormous funding apparatus that you can gerrymander either with respect to identifiable constituencies, student loans, or identifiable states, and that makes it much more dangerous and sectional in nature. Thank you.
Thank you very much to each panelist for your opening remarks. I'm going to ask a couple questions just to get the ball rolling on the discussion, but if folks want to start queuing on either side of the room, that's great, and we'll get to you as after the panelists have had a chance to respond to each other. So one thing that I heard from the all three of you is, as we're sort of thinking about this, and it raises one of the questions that I've thought about in studying federalism over the years too, which is that if you go back and you study the founding era history, as I know Professor Campbell has, I know both Professor Soman and Grieve have too, there's a lot of discussion at the founding of debating visions of federalism. In particular, you know, one of the anti-federalist criticisms of the new general government was, well, how in the world are we gonna have this new Congress work if the people in Georgia and the people in New York have very little in common? So I'm curious from a historical perspective if you see, is this really just a 240-year debate that's basically the same thing we were doing in 1789, or is there something different about today? And then, lest I disappoint my friend, Professor Grieve, by asking a question about what to do, what is the solution? What is there, you know, the only thing I heard in sort of ways to get at this was perhaps judicial enforcement, but obviously, as we know, there are lots of different ways to get at constitutional problems or federalism problems that don't involve the judiciary. So I'm curious about, to the extent that we can understand either this historical perspective or what to do about it in modern times, what folks think.
start off here. Two thoughts. One is, this is a point of contention at the founding, whether there is a sufficient commonality of interest to actually sustain a national polity. And you see posturing, even among some of the participants in the debates on both sides, in different directions. So Federalist One leads off with this statement of a national commonality of interest that is sufficient to sustain a national polity. And then you also see, in rejecting the calls for a Bill of Rights, Hamilton and Federalist 83 saying, no, we can't have a federal Bill of Rights. We're never going to be able to actually create the sort of statement of what the right to jury trial entails because there's too much disagreement among the several states on the content of the jury right. And then he follows that up in 84 with a comment about how the same thing applies to the freedom of the press. And so there's a debate here. The other aspect of the anti-federalist position that's worth emphasizing is it's not just a debate about commonality of interests. It's also a debate about the nature of democratic politics and whether that can actually work in a large enough polity where people don't know their representatives, they don't know their fellow citizens, and don't share the same sorts of interests as those fellow citizens. And so that's one of the primary bases for the anti-federalist position. It's not so much about small government as it is about preserving self-government, which they think requires a smaller republic where people can actually manage their own affairs in a more direct sense.
Okay. Thank you.
So I think there's sort of two questions. One is it really the same debate as they had at the founding? And second, what can be done about it?
Okay, sorry. I'll briefly repeat. I think there's only two questions here. One is, are we having the same debate as at the founding? And second, what can be done to alleviate the problems that have been identified? I think in some ways the debate is similar to at the founding in that they too, many of them worried that in a large, diverse society, it would be hard to have a unified central government and for various reasons. I do think things are worse in that respect now for two reasons. One is we're much bigger and more diverse than we were then. At the same time, we have a federal government that does much more even than Alexander Hamilton or James Wilson expected, the more nationalistic among the framers, much less the majority of the framers or majority of the ratifiers. So in that respect, things are worse with respect to that problem. On the issue of what can be done about it, I don't think there is a single silver bullet that can make these problems go away, but I do think stronger judicial review is a part of it, both with respect to more rigorous policing of the boundaries of federal power and less deference on such issues as the incredible scope of the commerce power, which has been taken to the absurd lengths of saying that the power to regulate interstate commerce includes the power to forbid possession of marijuana that has never crossed state lines and never even been sold in any market within a state. That's ridiculous, and that's also certainly bad for the structural reasons that we've talked about. There's a similar story about the spending power and some others, but I don't think judicial review can be the only piece of it. There also has to be a broader political movement, a broader recognition that we need to have less centralized control, but at the same time also that there are some individual rights, which once that we take account of the opportunity for people to vote with their feet and make decisions in the private sector, those individual rights, far from being the imposition of an anti-democratic elite, actually are ways to empower ordinary people to make more decisions for themselves in situations where they have the opportunity to first make an actual decisive choice, as opposed to being just one voter out of many millions, and second, make an informed choice, as opposed to what at the ballot box is usually a highly ignorant one. So there is no one single solution. I think there's a combination of legal and political action that should be taken. The last somewhat optimistic thing I'll say is that even if we never fully achieve the ideal balance here, the ideal system of federalism, we probably never will, or even come close, there's lots of room for incremental progress. We can devolve some issues that are desirable to devolve, even if we can't devolve all of them. we can strengthen some individual rights that enable people to vote with their feet more, even if we can't effectively deal with all the problems there, and that this is an area where there's a lot of room for incremental progress, which makes it different from perhaps some problems which are all or nothing in nature. Either you get it just right or you're screwed. The sort of reducing the over-centralization of power that we have now is not like that. We can make marginal improvements that still can make a real difference, even if we don't get everything right, and we won't.
As to, is this still the same problem as at the founding? The one obvious difference is that the founders wrote a constitution against parties, right? And how long did that last? And how well did that work for them? Well, maybe a year and a half, you know? And after that, it was already over. And with the rise of party government, I mean, the dynamics really, really change. And so it's very, very hard to compare. I'll say two things about, you know, what can be done. I'm actually, believe it or not, modestly optimistic. And the reason why I'm modestly optimistic at one front is the coming fiscal collapse. We have run over the past years $6 trillion in COVID funds, mostly through this cooperative conditional funding regime. Nobody knows where the money is. Nobody knows where it went. Okay, this cannot go on, period. And it won't go on. I mean, it's coming. Be prepared. You won't even make partner, most of you, before it happens, okay? How that ends, I do not know. But when people's backs are to the wall, they start to think and take things seriously. The other part is sort of more judicial enforcement, and Ilya has talked about one of these aspects, that is the scope of federal power. I'm less concerned about it than he is for various complicated reasons. I want to talk a little bit about the sort of horizontal federalism aspects, okay, that I was talking about. Steve Vladek yesterday said that, look, it's actually remarkable that the United States Supreme Court does not have a coherent theory that sort of fits sort of democratic government together with the forms of judicial review we actually have and the way the Supreme Court exercises it. He's entirely right about that. And I mean, with respect to the separation of powers, which was his theme, happy to give you examples. The same is true of sort of the horizontal federalism norms, right? The court is not interested in it. It doesn't want to deal with it. It doesn't want to think about it. It doesn't have a theory. Sometimes it ostentatiously says, we don't want to have a theory. However, there are, I mean, it's a hopeful sign that this term, they've not just taken this pork producer case, and after having denied cert in like 8, 9, 10 cases like that before, all of them from California, they've also taken a case about personal jurisdiction question. If you just register in a state, right, as a condition of business, doing business there, running your trains through the state, is that enough to give, I mean, to convey personal jurisdiction? It's totally possible that the Supremes will hack up both cases. Both of those ought to be easy, okay? Open and shut, and instead they agonize over these cases. But at least they've taken them. And I believe there are lots of questions, legal questions, that implicate sort of these horizontal federalism concerns that they're going to have to deal with. One of them is the question of universal injunctions, right? That's obviously sort of horizontal federalism's theme, right? You run into one court of your own selection and then impose, an injunctive relief on the rest of the country, including 15, 20, 30 states that really don't want it, right? And state standing to sue is the other problem that is just like that. And they will have to, view those legal problems, which you can discuss from all kinds of angles, from the vantage point of what does this do to interstate relations, because it stares you in the face.
Thank you. Let's start over on this side. If you would tell us some, if, for the students, which school you're from, and if you're directing your question to a particular panelist, please let us know.
Yes, my name is Andrew Perong, and I'm from Temple University. My question is mainly directed toward Professor Grieba. I don't think that I'm in a minority by saying here that I'm no big fan of the Supreme Court's Commerce Clause jurisprudence, but the pork producer case raises an interesting question, which you raised about raising rivals' costs, and obviously the, you know, defense that these states are going to say is, well, you know, this action violates the Dormant Commerce Clause because it interferes on other states' ability to interact with other states and do interstate commerce and raises their costs. So was sort of wondering how we square sort of this Dormant Commerce Clause argument with this position, which is almost goes contrary to our federal system of commerce, of the Commerce Clause.
Yeah, it's a terrific question. Let me take one step back and then hopefully answer it directly, okay? What are the two doctrines that in the 19th century served as the principal instruments of economic and political integration in the United States? The answer is the doctrine of Swift versus Tyson, and the other one is the Dormant Commerce Clause. No serious constitutional historian doubts this, okay? Which are the doctrines that you are not ever permitted to mention in original circles these days? Swift versus Tyson and the Dormant Commerce Clause, which does not exist, okay? And if you say, wait a minute, this just makes no sense, certain kinds of originalists will say, I agree it makes no sense, it's absurd, but that just shows how principled we are. That is the obstacle you have to get over, okay? The best brief in that pork producer case, and I don't mean to upset Ilya, but I'll say it nonetheless. It's a brief on behalf of the Chamber of Commerce. It's written by Michael McConnell and Stephen Johnson, formerly with Winston Strom now.
Why would that upset me?
No, what comes now will upset you. Okay. And the brief, it doesn't mention the Dormant Commerce Clause with one word, okay? Why not? Because you have the three liberal justices against you anyhow, okay? The word you write, the minute you write Dormant Commerce Clause into a brief, you have three other votes against you. That will be Justice Thomas, Justice Gorsuch, the Chief, okay? So you have to argue, you have to do this differently. And the way Michael goes about this is, I realize when it comes to the horizontal federalism structure of the Constitution, I cannot just tell the Supreme Court Manhattan is an island. I have to explain to them Manhattan is an island surrounded by water. And I will now walk them through the territorial nature of statehood and what states can and cannot do to one another under the United States Constitution as it is structured, okay? And that entails, among other things, and means, among other things, the Commerce Clause is an exclusive power, not a concurrent power, okay? And once you say it's an exclusive power, you've said it's a dormant power, and then you just have to spell that out further. And once you approach the problem in that, from that sort of high level of analysis, it all falls into place. The difficulty is you have to rely on distinctions, categorical distinctions, but that we haven't had in 80 years. But that's why it's an amicus brief.
Thank you. Still not upset. I will merely say, however, that if you're going to say that the Commerce Clause is an exclusive power, it just can't have the enormous vast scope that it does under current Supreme Court jurisprudence. It would have to have a much narrower scope, and even then you would have to talk about sort of you know, how exclusive is it really, in that I still don't think it can be exclusive in a sense that anything that affects interstate commerce in any significant way has to be exclusively federal. There's one other last point about this that I would comment on a little bit, and that is sort of the notion of raising rivals' costs. Usually the way that works is like two entities are in the same market, and one says, like, you know, I can't beat the other guy, so I'm gonna raise his costs, and then, you know, I'm gonna sell my otherwise inferior or more costly product. But here, if I understand correctly what you said, Michael, and you can correct me if I got it wrong, California is not actually in the business of raising and selling pork. They're in the business of buying pork, so they're gonna raise the costs of the producers of the pork that they buy, thereby also raising costs that California consumers pay. That might be a bad thing, but I don't really see it as raising rivals' costs. Maybe the real answer is that the real costs are being raised is that, like, they're all in the market for citizens and businesses, and so if the economy of the pork-producing state is less productive, then California gains. But of course, here California is raising its own costs as well, in particular, raising the cost of living, getting this product that lots of Californians buy. So while I'm no fan of this California pork regulation, I'm not sure that dormant commerce clause and raising and also raising rivals' costs are the best sort of mechanisms for thinking about what's wrong with it.
Yeah, please.
Just one small intervention here. So in the historical cases that Michael's talking about with respect to dormant commerce clause, there's a sense that the commerce clause and the dormant commerce clause are two sides of the same coin. And one of the really important developments in the era of, for instance, the Shreveport rape cases is the sort of breaking down of that dichotomy through the necessary and proper clause. And one of the things that's kind of then interesting about some of the subsequent dormant commerce clause cases is picking that then up under the dormant principles that might be best described as dormant necessary and proper clause. So it's a sort of extension of an earlier logic. And I again think that that logic is defensible if you have a conception of what the nature of the union is that's very capacious and very problematic from a historical standpoint if you're thinking about it in a more Jeffersonian or Madisonian way.
Thank you. Let's go to the side on the room.
Thank you. My name is Michael Bickett. I'm from Texas A&M Law. So I was thinking about the four modes of considering the relationship between the states and the federal government. And do you think that the nationalistic views, actually, sorry, I'm directing this more to Professor Campbell. Do you think that the nationalistic views of Marshall and Wilson that have controlled, perhaps more so since the end of the Civil War, have led to the rise of the idea in the American psyche that major questions of policy, such as questions regarding same-sex marriage, for example, have to be decided at the federal level in order to enforce unity across the nation? And if so, then these nationalistic views seem to be destroying a major advantage in federalism, which is allowing different people in different places to decide how they govern themselves. And if that's the case, would a shift in the American psyche to the Madisonian/Jefferson view of the relationship between the states and the federal government be an antidote to this erosion in federalism?
Yeah, that's a really nice point. That is to say that the questions about federal power are actually complementary to the questions about national rights enforcement. And this is the way that people at the founding and during Reconstruction are thinking about the problem. That is, it's not a separate question of what Article I powers entail and what national rights might exist, but they're actually thought of as being complementary. And so if you're worried especially about the nationalization of our conception of who we are and the way in which that affects the Constitution, it shouldn't just be a concern about Article I, it's also a concern about the nationalization of rights. Now, here I'm speaking historically, not normatively. So there might be normatively appealing reasons for treating rights different than powers, but historically, I think it's right to see them as paired. Oftentimes, you don't see this, so I can think of one scholar, for sake of anonymity, let's call him Randy Burnett, who has a very, very nationalistic conception about rights, but also not a nationalistic conception of powers. And that neatly fits onto his account historically of the way in which the founders in 1787 are thinking about Article I and the way then that the Reconstruction Congress is thinking about the 14th Amendment in particular. And one of the really fascinating parts of thinking through this problem historically is that, that might not be the right frame if you think that the reading of the Constitution depends on some underlying pre-political conception of what the nature of the union is.
Just very briefly on this, in that I don't think there's necessarily a contradiction either today in terms of normative values or even historically of thinking of a national or even universal conception of rights versus a more limited conception of powers, because both the framers in the 18th century and also many of the Reconstruction era thinkers as well were heavily influenced by theories of universal natural rights, and many, not all, but many of the rights in the Bill of Rights and in the Reconstruction Amendments arise directly from this sort of universalistic understanding of natural rights, which they thought all people everywhere should be entitled to, whereas the powers of government are, by their nature, at least for the most part, more instrumental, more subject to variation, not inherently valuable, but and therefore in a more diverse society, maybe you would want to decentralize them, or a bigger society, you would want to decentralize them. Whereas if you believe in natural rights theory, which most of the leading legal and political thinkers of both of these eras did believe in it, then it makes perfect sense to say that a lot of rights, including rights to liberty and property, which are the most significant ones that they were talking about, that those rights should be universal, that any free person should have them, and also that many of them recognized certainly that the institution of slavery was incompatible with this as well. And as we also recognize over time that, you know, women should be equal with men, that the women should have them as well as men, and so on. That still leaves open question of sort of what exactly did these rights mean, and how do we interpret natural rights theory, and there was some disagreement among that back then, as there certainly would be today, but it's not inherently contradictory to think of rights as being more national and really more universal in nature than powers of government are, which are more specific and don't have any intrinsic value and therefore more subject to different necessities and conveniences of time and place.
Can I respond briefly? No, so I agree that the conception from the founding through Reconstruction is that the citizens of all the states have an underlying common bucket of rights. The key question then is which political entity has the power to regulate and to define those rights. And I think that's the place where you see the division between the radical Republicans during Reconstruction, who are asserting a nationalistic vision of that power to define and regulate, versus the position that I think is true to Bingham's original vision of the 14th Amendment, which is to preserve state regulatory authority but to recognize a role for national institutions to identify abridgments, which is to say cases in which the state has acted beyond its police powers. So I do agree with Ilya that it's a common bucket of rights. They are, in an older sense, grounded in general law, and then the key division is the power to regulate.
Please.
Hi. Aaron Bonder. I'm from the Fordham Law Chapter. So my question was a bit preempted, and I really enjoyed this conversation, but I waited up here anyway, so I'm going to ask it a bit more provocatively, which I plan to do anyway. The question over you know, states' powers and individual rights, the nationalization of rights, I think is a very interesting topic, and it seems like people who call themselves Federalists or who support the idea of federalism actually don't want to put their money where their mouth is, right? We have a sense that we want federalism in all the unimportant questions, but the important questions, you know, that's, well, those things are untouchable. And so in your framework, Professor Campbell, and this is a question for all of you, we're all nationalists now, right? We don't want to see a diversity of ways of living. We don't want to see people living their lives in different ways, and I think our current media environment just, you know, feeds that. So, you know, if we were really federalists, right, if we really put our money where our mouth is, that would really revolutionize the way we think about current Supreme Court jurisprudence. It would mean a reapproachment, an expansion of state police power. It would mean an expansion of, a weakening of current Supreme Court doctrine on, like, strict scrutiny. And so I don't see that happening anytime soon. I would like to see it happen, but I would ask you, I mean, are we willing to, you know, sort of give up the sort of conservative, sort of libertarian approach to these individual rights in order to have a more expansive vision of what states can and can't do? Or do you think that's completely off the table and we should, you know, let them, our idea of diversity can remain, well, you can have a different healthcare system and, like, you can have some Medicaid funding, like, you know, these really unimportant but orthogonal questions. Thank you.
So that may be in part directed at me, and I'm sure others have things to say as well. So I'd say there is no contradiction between having strong individual rights and having respect for a variety of different ways of living, precisely because in many areas, not in all, but in many, having strong individual rights actually means having more different ways of living that are tolerated and more choice for more different kinds of people than there is if it's a lot of power is left in the hands of state police power or state regulation. I'm not saying every single issue can be handled this way, because I said before, there are certain societal problems that can only be handled at the national level or some only at the state level, but there's many more that can be handled by the private sector and by people cooperating voluntarily in a wide diversity of ways, and is currently the case. And I also think it just does not seem to me that something like autonomy over healthcare or education, or for that matter, even law enforcement and the like, police power as you call it, that that's somehow unimportant. This affects the lives of millions of people in all sorts of different ways. So if those kind of things are left to some combination of state or private decision making, then, or even, you know, some of them are left to, you know, the states have wide power, that's still a lot of pretty important stuff. Some of it is not at the forefront of today's culture war, which instead focuses on what seem to be actually much less significant issues, like, you know, how many drag shows should be allowed and, like, who should be able to go to them and so forth. But these things nonetheless have a huge effect on people's lives, even if they're not always in the headlines. And so I think there is a consistency between saying structurally federal power should be much more severely limited than it is now, but also certain individual rights should be at least as strong as they are now and maybe stronger, because that's an even greater level of decentralization and diversity than if these things are left under the control of state governments.
I'll chime in just to say, I think that there is a tension here, and it's one worth grappling with and thinking about, particularly for those of you who think of yourselves as originalists. I say with a high degree of confidence that the people who passed the 14th Amendment would have been okay with differential state treatment of swearing on social media for JV cheerleading disciplinary purposes. And so trying to figure out what to do with that then today requires grappling with what to do with precedent, what to do with sort of background assumptions about what our status is as a people, and so on. And I think those are problems really worth thinking through. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Hello, my name is Gregory Fasliotis, Texas A&M. My question is for Professor Soman. Foot voting is something that I have greatly benefited from. My grandparents fled war and occupation and came to New York, and then in 2020, I left New York for Texas because of the political situation. I wasn't able to work and all those things. But and obviously those things greatly benefited me, because it allows me to work and all the benefits I have here. But with each one of those moves, there was also, I mean, great negatives. I mean, there was separation from family, loss of identity from having to move, cultural loss of friends and the community. And I was just wondering if you could speak to those negatives and how that still plays into your sunny disposition on the utility of foot voting. Thank you.
That's a great question. And what you're pointing to is the problem of moving cost, that when you vote with your feet, and it's rarely completely costless, there's the immediate cost, so I have to take my stuff and move it, but often there's bigger costs. I might have to switch jobs, I'm separated from my family, I'm in a new cultural environment and setting. All of those can be costly. I answered a question more fully, and I'll engage in shameless self-promotion. I have a book called Free to Move, where I have an entire section devoted to moving costs. And I think the problem cannot be 100% overcome, but there's ways to reduce it. One is decentralizing the lower levels of government, in some cases localities rather than states, can enable people to get options by moving less far away. So maybe You wouldn't have to move from all the way from New York to Texas, not to knock the state of Texas that we're in, but maybe you could move from one city in New York to another 50 miles away. It'll be less costly. Secondly, if you allow more devolution to the private sector, often you can vote with your feet in the private sector without physically changing your residence at all. I gave the example of school choice, I think earlier in this panel. That's just one example of how that can be done. Third, it is indeed true that for some moves, particularly long distance ones, and I don't think we can ever completely eliminate the need for them, there will be still significant moving costs, but if the differences in quality of government are big enough, they may be worth it. My parents and I moved from the Soviet Union, pretty substantial moving costs, but a difference was easily worth it. And while the differences between American states, fortunately, are not as big as those between the Soviet Union and a liberal democracy, still they can be big enough to justify the cost. I guess the last thing I would say is that there are also various transaction costs and other kinds of costs to doing things through government as well, or to doing things through the unitary state. There's enormous waste and other kinds of problems associated with that. So as always, you have to compare foot voting not to ideal alternatives, but to what can be realistically achieved. And the same thing is true on the foot voting side as well. Like, I'm not going to point you to an ideal of frictionless foot voting where, like, we can move at zero cost, because I admit, for the most part, you know, that isn't possible.
Thank you.
Sure, over here.
My name is Gianna Patchett from BYU Law. And this is just kind of a general question for all of you. I think a lot of this conversation has been very high level and or very specific to this type of a community. And I think a lot of times I see the general populace seeing the federal government as the entity that fixes everything, right? That's their perception of the federal government. And they're maybe disproportionately interested in their local governments and participating there. And I think that kind of is very counterintuitive to federalism and trying to promote kind of this type of ideology. And so I was wondering what, I guess, ideas or what sorts of things we should be or can be doing to try to shift this general idea that the federal government is where we fix all of our problems.
Yeah, my sense is, sorry, I'm just waiting for the microphone to kick in. I'm not stalling, okay? My general sense is, for the longest time, or for quite some time, you're right, state governments were sort of the least attended to level of government, right? I mean, people do care what happens immediately in their neighborhood. I care a great deal about the Alexandria City Council, right? Because that's my roads, that's the schools, da-da-da-da-da, right? Pay attention to the Congress because, you know, it dominates the airwaves. What happens in Richmond? What do I know? My sense is that that has been shifting and changing over the past years for a whole variety of reasons, beginning sort of with the sort of much more prominent stature of state governors, right? Many of them now sort of headline making in their own right, to the complete demobilization of Congress, which everybody realizes it's just performance art. It's not legislating, right? And so people naturally look elsewhere to the mobilization of groups who sort of for the longest time have sort of looked to Washington because, oh, that's where we have to do stuff, right? Now realize, no, that's hopeless anyhow. So let's focus on what we can manage and handle. So I think just as a sheer matter of demand side dynamics, there will be a lot more attention to state governments, state legislatures, state governor's offices, state AG's offices, regardless of whether we do anything about it.
So I think it's a good question. And what is really going on, I think, is that the public has sort of a dualistic attitude towards these things. On the one hand, you're right. Anytime a problem comes up, people are like, well, what's the president going to say about it or do about it, or what? Sometimes what Congress will. So anytime there's a
a publicized shooting, people say, well, how's Joe Biden going to react, or whoever's president at the time, even though often whatever happened has nothing to do with his sphere of authority or very little to do with it. And I decry that attitude. It's a bad thing. On the other hand, if you look at survey data, much of the public on many issues will say they have greater trust in state or local government than they do in the federal government. Many, many governors have much higher approval ratings than the president almost always does. State and local governments often have higher approval ratings than Congress does, but their approval rating is in the toilet for many years now, around 20 or 25%. So it seems to me, therefore, this somewhat greater trust in the lower levels of government can be built on to help justify and push through constraints on the federal government. And also, of course, there's a great distrust of government in general that has grown. Sometimes it's channeled towards demagoguery, like a certain politician who said, I alone can fix it. You can't trust these other politicians, but I can be trusted. I'll do everything. And so there is that risk that distrust can lead to sort of, somebody says, give all the power to me and I'll fix the problem. But perhaps it can also be channeled into more productive directions of having greater decentralization, greater competition, and more of a role for the private sector as well. On many of these issues of sort of the structure of government, division of powers, and federalism, most ordinary citizens, for understandable reasons, haven't given careful thought as part of the rational ignorance that I talked about earlier, and therefore it might be possible to channel things in different kinds of directions and perhaps more productive kind of directions than some of those that we've seen in recent years.
Hello, my name is Anthony Leonardi. I'm from the University of South Dakota. So I had a question that dovetails off of last night's panel describing the United States as like an ecosystem of reasonable pluralism, and then the things that you guys have talked about from an original meaning perspective. So when I think of the original meaning, or at least the original use of federalism, I think of the Latin derivative voterati, meaning covenant or bond. And how it was used by Publius in the Federalist Papers is the union by which that bond is created, that Alexander Hamilton and Madison, vehemently advocated for. How does voting with your feet sort of accord with that original understanding or use of federalism as a term? And my second question was, from last night, do you think that in a federalist system like ours that the federal government should provide, be some sort of gatekeeper for what is reasonable in a world of reasonable pluralism?
So one of the founding fathers had many great ideas, but they did have some blind spots. And one of their blind spots was, if you look at all the records of the debates about federalism at the time, there is almost no discussion of interstate mobility or voting with your feet or any concept like that. So I think it's a lacuna in their thought. Nonetheless, I think it's very compatible with many ideas that they did have, such as a government with limited enumerated powers, therefore leaving scope for foot voting. And both in the 18th century and later, there was a sense that one of the rights of a free person was, in fact, the right of mobility. You saw this even more with discussions of these issues later in the 19th century, where mobility becomes a big issue with states, some states trying to exclude free blacks, and later with the debates at a Reconstruction Congress and the Reconstruction Amendments and the like. So I think foot voting and mobility can fit into their vision of national rights and or natural rights and limited powers, even though I do think that for the original framers, much less so for the Reconstruction framers, but for the original framers, it was a blind spot in terms of what they actually discussed. As to reasonable pluralism, I have to admit, because I had a competing engagement, I wasn't at last night's panel, but it does sound like one of those terms that at a high level of generality, everybody could agree on who would want to be unreasonable or who would want to be completely against pluralism, but often sort of the devil is in the details. So I certainly contend foot voting is compatible with reasonable pluralism and with any reasonable conception thereof, but undoubtedly some others might disagree and would say that they have a conception of reasonable pluralism, which takes a dimmer view of foot voting.
Just sort of two quick remarks. I agree with Ilya's remark about sort of blind spot except it's part of a much bigger blind spot, if you want to call it this, right? You read the Federalist, there's not a really serious argument for federalism in there at all, right? They had lots of good arguments for a big country, right? An extended republic. But the states are mostly there because you have to deal with them. And had they not already existed, there ain't no way the founders would have created or invented them, right? So the sort of inattention to sort of mobility is part of that, right? You can find sort of scraps that, I mean, certain things that Hamilton, Madison, Governor Morris wrote about it and said about it outside the convention, outside the constitutional debates. But that's mostly about sort of political economy, not sort of high-level constitutional thought. One last remark about sort of the pluralism. We should mention, in fairness, and Ilya knows much more about this part of the debate than I do, that our view, our common view of how federalism ought to operate and how sort of the dynamic between diversity and, you know, being one country ought to operate is not everyone's view, right? So Dean Heather Gerken, Jessica Bowman defend a very different view of federalism as democratic engagement and democratic contention. And the argument that they like least is that, well, federalism allows us to go our separate ways. What they want to say is, no, that's the one thing we shouldn't do, because what you want is sort of engagement with people who disagree with you at closer range and across levels of government. I hope that was roughly fair.
For the most part, I think it is, though. I have engaged with then professor and now Dean Gerken a lot, and I have argued, and she has partly accepted, only partly, that some of her notions are reinforced and can be actuated by having limits on national power in some cases, and also even sometimes by foot voting. In particular, she has a notion of second order diversity, which says that even though particular states or particular regions may not be internally diverse, they contribute to the diversity of the overall system, because it means there's lots of different options in the system. She and I do part ways on some issues, and if you're interested in this, I have a whole article where I explain that how her notions actually might be better realized by combining them with tighter limits on power and more foot voting than Heather would allow. So she and I have been engaged in this for many years.
So I would say that the right to travel among states is a recognized right in Article 4, that the Privileges and Immunities Clause picks up that right. And one of the reasons why you don't see so much discussion of that at the founding is that it's already a background principle and the Constitution is doing nothing to change it. And so there's no reason to debate that aspect of the Constitution. Two nuances here are, one, the right to travel outside the realm, so a right of expatriation, and that actually does get debated to some extent, the ability to leave a political community. You don't need to exercise that right when you're moving among states because you have that right as a citizen of the United States. But there is some debate about the conditions under which you can leave citizenship. And then the other sort of nuance here is that there are regulations of the right to travel at the founding that are class-based, and so the poor laws of the various states do limit in some ways the ability of some people who are subject to basically the 18th century equivalent of welfare to travel among various towns and potentially across state lines. But for the most part, I think the right to travel would be a recognized right.
When I said that it was a blind spot, I didn't mean that there was no right to travel, but rather that they didn't think systematically about things like competition between states for residents, things like choosing one state or another because you like the policies better and the like. But I totally mm-hmm. agree with what you said about the right and also about the poor law aspect as well. You're absolutely right about that.
With apologies to those who, to the questions we didn't get to, I'm afraid we're out of time, and so we'll have to leave it there. It's a symptom, I suppose, of a great panel and wonderful panelists. So please join me in thanking everyone for the discussion.